This is continuing coverage of the trial of Karen Reed from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. Now, back to the courtroom.
I'm happy to do it. Starting with Brian Higgins. He was present at 34 Fairview Road on January 28th to 29th. He was close friends with the homeowner, Brian Albert. He had a prior romantic interest in Karen Reed. He did not expect Karen and John O'Keefe to be at the waterfall, that bar, on January 28th. Karen Reed did not greet Higgins, despite the fact that they had previously exchanged flirtatious texts and that she had been at his apartment one evening, although there was nothing that took place between them any more than a peck of a kiss. At the waterfall, Higgins does not engage with John O'Keefe. He does not say goodbye to John O'Keefe and Karen when he leaves, but before he leaves, he texts Karen, and that text was something to the effect of, well, with a lot of M's. We know that there was a preservation order from this court, your predecessor, Judge Krupp, to preserve his cell phone, and that Trooper Proctor gave an order to serve on Brian Higgins, and he left it at the front desk of the Canton Police Station for him, and that Higgins, we learned through the federal investigation, Higgins became angry, demanded that Proctor come back, and he essentially upbraided him and read him the Riot Act, which shows a little bit about Higgins' personality. At the end of the night, everyone discussed going back to 34 Fairview, and when he gets back to 34 Fairview, he texts not Karen, he texts John O'Keefe at 12:20 a.m. He testified before the federal grand jury that he had no knowledge that they had been invited to 34 Fairview, but that is contradicted by this text message. And the inference is that he was coaxing John to come to that house. And, you know, we're not saying this gives him a motive to kill John, but we don't have to show that. Any motive to feel hostility or animosity towards John O'Keefe goes to his motive. And Your Honor, when Brian Higgins and Brian Albert are in that house, they're the only two people who are unaccounted for when the rest of the group was in the kitchen. And they claimed that they were looking at photographs together. And we have evidence that they were in the basement. We believe that Brian Albert made a mistake before the state grand jury by testifying they went upstairs to look at photos. Brian Higgins says unequivocally that the only place the two went was into the living room to look at photos, the military ribbons, whatever they were looking at. Brian Higgins did not know that Brian Albert had said they went upstairs. And he also testified he had never been upstairs at Brian Albert's house in his life. That means that if Brian Albert said they went upstairs, they're coming up from the basement. And before leaving 34 Fairview, Brian Higgins testified he was parked right in front of the mailbox. He would have had to have walked by where John O'Keefe's body was. His headlights, when he got in his vehicle, would have been illuminating where John O'Keefe's body would have been in the yard if it were actually there. So how does he not see it? He then goes back to the Canton Police Station at 1:30 in the morning after leaving 34 Fairview. He claimed to do some administrative work, but then he admitted to the federal grand jury that he was there to move his car because of the upcoming snowstorm. This suggests that he was fabricating a reason for going back to Canton Police to establish an alibi for himself. He was asked several times at the federal grand jury if he had any conversations with anyone before he went to bed, and when was he notified that John O'Keefe was dead? In the morning, he said. He testified under the pains and penalties of perjury that he had absolutely no contact with any person that night for any reason whatsoever. But he apparently was surprised that the federal authorities had subpoenaed his phone records, and he had to admit, and he did admit under oath, he made that 2:22 a.m. phone call. Around the same time, about 5 minutes before Jennifer McCabe is Googling how long to die in the cold, about 8 minutes before Brian Loughran, the plow driver, first drives by the house and sees nobody at all. And the next morning, Brian Higgins, the first person he spoke to was Brian Albert.
I'm going to stop you for a minute. I think we need a break, Madam Court Reporter. Do you need a break? Can you go? How much longer do you think you have with this, Mr. Iannetti? How many more pages or how long you think?
Yeah, I've got about, in terms of my recitation of the facts, I've done about a page and a half and I've got three left.
Madam Court Reporter, would you like to take a little break? It's hot in here and you've been going nonstop. Okay, let's take a 10-minute break.
Football, right? Let's stand for a brief recess.
All right, Mr. Iannetti, go right ahead.
Thank you. Your Honor, I left off with the morning of January 29th. The first person that Brian Higgins spoke to was Brian Albert. He had missed a call from Chief Kenneth Berkowitz earlier. Immediately after getting off the phone with Brian Albert, Brian Higgins drives back to 34 Fairview, where he has a meeting with just about all the witnesses in this case, Brian Albert, Julie Albert, Jennifer McCabe, Matthew McCabe. And immediately after that friends and family meeting, on his day off, which is a Saturday, he returns to the Canton Police Department, where he speaks with all of the first responding officers who had anything to do with this case. So this is a quote-unquote witness accessing and communicating with all the first responding officers, we would argue monitoring what they're doing in regard to the investigation. According to Brian Higgins, he admitted that Chief Berkowitz is one of his best friends, and that's why he had access to all these people. We have a law enforcement witness who will testify long time.
So is this a name that's been in the materials? Is this a name known to the Commonwealth? Or
yes.
Is this somebody new? Okay.
We've now received video surveillance from the Canton Police Department that shows that there is an interior camera in the Sallyport garage where the car was housed. But during the exact time that third party officer indicates that Berkowitz and Higgins were in the Sallyport together, the video mysteriously cuts out for 42 minutes between 5:08 between 5:08 and 5:50 p.m. And just to be clear here, we never get to see the condition of the taillight when it's brought into the garage. When we do see the car, we see it after Brian Higgins, Chief Berkowitz, Michael Proctor, and Yuri Buchnik have all had access to it. At 5:36 p.m., the car pings that it's arrived in the Sallyport. That's during the missing video. Trooper Proctor, Trooper Buchnik never sees Brian Higgins' phone. They speak with him, and he takes it upon himself to use his own resources, Brian Higgins, within the federal government to ask a friend, Special Agent Mac Kelch, to download only the text messages in his phone between Karen and him and John. And that's it. We have to take his word for it that we got all of them. And we certainly don't have any communications between him and Brian Albert, for instance. On February 10th, when he shows up to his interview with Troopers Buchnik and Proctor, he brings with him copies of the text that he has deemed relevant in their murder investigation. And he hands them the copies of the extraction that he had his friend do. He then calls Matt Kelch the weekend of this extracted the tests, despite the fact that it was done by a friend of his in the federal government. During the federal proffer, Brian Higgins admits that he had been served with a preservation order and the Commonwealth told him he could destroy his phone despite the order. He then drives to a military base on Cape Cod opens his phone, breaks the SIM card, and throws the phone away. And he says that he discussed destroying his phone with Brian Albert. Brian Albert also destroyed his phone. And Brian Albert said that he had received some text that concerns him as an explanation. And after that, Brian Higgins changes his phone number and changes his cell carrier. In short, he was present that night. He had a motive, and there is plenty of consciousness of guilt cover-up evidence with regard to Mr. Higgins. Moving on to Colin Albert. Shortly before January 29th of 2022, Colin Albert lived with his parents, Christopher Albert and Julie Albert, on John O'Keefe's street, just two doors down. We have evidence of bad blood between Colin Albert and John O'Keefe. We have evidence.
How old was Colin Albert at that time?
I believe he was 16 at that time.
Okay.
We have evidence that Colin Albert and John O'Keefe used to get in confrontations because Colin Albert used to cut through his yard without permission, and John O'Keefe was not happy about that. We have evidence that Colin Albert used to throw beer cans intentionally into John O'Keefe's bushes, and John O'Keefe was not happy about that. We have evidence that Christopher and Julie Albert knew of this conflict. We have evidence that they referred to John O'Keefe as Nebercracker. That's a character from a kid's movie, who was known as the get off my lawn guy. When John O'Keefe and Karen Reed were vacationing in Aruba over New Year's Eve 2022, the Alberts, Christopher and Julie, taunted him. They went to his porch and they had photos taken of themselves drinking on John's property when he wasn't there to do anything about it, evidencing they knew how upset he was at what Colin Albert had been doing. Now, the investigators in this case, Your Honor, including Michael Proctor, kept Colin Albert's name completely out of the police report. When this case began, I had no idea who Colin Albert was. I received a tip right from the jump that Brian Albert and his nephew had beaten up John O'Keefe. I didn't even know Brian Albert had a nephew at that time. But after receiving the tip, I learned of the conflict that Colin Albert had with John O'Keefe. So I sent a letter to Mr. Lally, I believe by certified mail. I knew that the DA's office was planning to present evidence or witnesses to a grand jury. And at that early juncture, before anybody had asked them to indict, I notified the DA of three potential suspects, the ones that I'm talking about now, Brian Higgins, Brian Albert, and Colin Albert. After he received that letter at our next court appearance, I'm sure Mr. Lally can confirm this, he acknowledged that both Brian Albert and Brian Higgins would be testifying or had testified before the grand jury, but he questioned why I included Colin Albert in my letter. He told me at the time that he had no evidence that Colin Albert was there that night. However, after receiving my letter, lo and behold, multiple witnesses testified that Colin Albert was at 34 Fairview the night of January 28th to 29th. And now the DA will argue, I'm sure, at trial, that he left before John O'Keefe arrived. We don't find their evidence compelling. We don't accept it. We are not required to accept their theory of the case. We're entitled to present a defense. His presence at 34 Fairview gave him the opportunity, along with the motive, to harm John O'Keefe. With regard to Brian Albert, Your Honor, this is a well-connected, well-known, powerful family in the town of Canton, Massachusetts. Brian Albert was present at that home when Colin Albert was there. Colin Albert is a member of the Albert family. He's nephew of Brian Albert. We have evidence that Brian Albert had expressed hostility toward John O'Keefe as well. And we know that he initiated a phone call with Brian Higgins at 2:22 in the morning. He reached out to Brian Higgins. And then he picked up the phone when Brian Higgins came back and they spoke for 22 seconds. And they never revealed any of that to investigators. Again, consciousness of guilt, and perhaps most of all, Brian Albert is a first responder. He is duty bound to help somebody who's in trouble. He was notified that John O'Keefe was in trouble. Brian Albert stayed in his home. He knew what was going on outside. His sister-in-law was out there, civilians, medical personnel eventually arrived. He did nothing. That is also consciousness of guilt. Now, Your Honor, with regard to all of that third-party culprit evidence, to admit it substantively, which I would assert to the court is both overwhelming and powerful, with regard to the Bowdoin argument here, the police investigated none of that. That didn't come from the Commonwealth. They had a complete lack of curiosity as to what was going on in that house that night. They didn't care. Investigators never went in. The feds investigated, and that's where we got a majority of this evidence. So, you know, to the extent that the Commonwealth now claims that they didn't have notice of this, I beg to defer. They got notice of this when we got notice of this. You know, the Finney case, Your Honor, again, I'm well familiar with it. It stood for the proposition that, you know, if you want to point the finger at a third-party culprit, you've got a constitutional right to do that. And if you want to point out inadequacies in a police investigation, you have a constitutional right to do that. Right? It's for those reasons that I ask you to deny the Commonwealth's motions.
Okay. Thank you. Any response, Mr. Lally?
Briefly, Your Honor.
Just first, again, what the case law requires is evidence and not just mere speculation, or saying that you have evidence is not actually evidence. I do find it somewhat interesting that Mr. Iannetti wrote apparently 4.5 pages of notes but didn't have time to write a motion to admit the evidence that he claims that he has. He references in regard to third-party culprit Dr. Sheridan, who indicated that the injuries are consistent with the fight. He's the same doctor who indicated that the injuries on Mr. O'Keefe's arm were consistent with the dog bite, which was then refuted by the DNA findings from UC Davis, as well as the fact that the injuries are only on one side of the arm. And last time I checked, dogs have teeth on the top and the bottom, and there's no injuries to the bottom of Mr. O'Keefe's arm. Furthermore, the counsel references the federal grand jury materials, in which I would say, as has been done numerous times previously, is severely mischaracterized as to what they actually contain. And it's not a crash reconstructionist as it's been alleged here before, it's a biomechanical engineer. And essentially what they did was take painstaking lengths to determine that the defendant's vehicle did not strike Mr. O'Keefe in the back of the head, which is simply something that no one has ever said, intimated at any point ever. There is also a medical examiner in the federal materials who concurs completely with Dr. Scordibello's findings as it pertains to the cause and manner of death. So with regard to each of these, the other thing that I would point out is, if counsel was counsel record with the Finney case relates to third-party culprit under the Bowdoin defense. So it's not applicable to what counsel was arguing. It is a low standard, but it's also one that the defendant here has not met. It's not one without limits. As it pertains to much of the material that it was summarized as far as speculation as to what different things counsel feels mean from various things regarding Mr. Higgins, Colin Albert, and Brian Albert. Just starting with Colin Albert, because that's frankly the easiest. He wasn't at the house, and that's what the federal materials confirm with each of every single of the witnesses that were spoken to by the district attorney's office or the troopers or testified to the state grand jury. They testified to the exact same things in the federal grand jury, that Colin Albert had left the house prior to the defendant and the victim arriving there, and there's absolutely nothing to combat that whatsoever, other than, again, just rank speculation. So opportunity would be a little bit amiss if he's not even there at the same time as Mr. O'Keefe, regardless of the invalidity of any sort of ill feelings or ongoing feud that's purported from whatever unknown evidence counsel claims to have. In regard to Mr. Higgins, that was a fanciful story. But again, there's actually no actual evidence of most of those things, or at least the imputations or the connotations the council wants to put behind that. Whatever he feels, things were observed. Again, I'm not sure where the evidence from this is coming from. What I'm also a little confused in regard to is that if counsel is merely relying on materials within the federal grand jury and just learned of them at that same time as we learned of them when materials were provided pursuant to TUI, then it's a little peculiar that the exact same arguments were being made throughout the pendency of the case well before counsel was provided with any of those federal materials. What counsel just went through is essentially a list of rank speculation and not actual evidence. As far as the mysterious portion that's missing from the Sallyport, there's a number of different, it's a motion activated camera for the most part. The other thing that I would direct the court's attention to, as it was contained within the state grand jury proceedings, is cruiser camera video from the Canton Police cruisers. Specifically, there is cruiser camera video from cruiser 682. Specifically, there is cruiser camera video from cruiser 682 at 8:22 in the morning when a lieutenant and sergeant from the Canton Police on their own go over to One Meadows Ave, which is the residence of Mr. O'Keefe, to do a well-being check because they had not received any information as to how the children were or if they were there being attended. Kay parked it when they stopped there to see if Mr. O'Keefe was there before then piling into Ms. Roberts' vehicle and proceeding to 34 Fairview. And what you can see within that cruiser camera video at 8:22 in the morning is the damage to the right rear taillight of the defendant's vehicle. Well before the defendant had then come back to the house after the hospital and then gotten in three separate cars with her family and driven in a blizzard all the way back to her parents' house in Dighton, and then the vehicle had then been towed from Dighton back to the Canton Police Station by the state police with the assistance of the Dighton Police.
Do you know what exhibit number that is before the grand jury?
I believe it's 56, but I can certainly locate that information. And again, as far as Brian Albert is concerned, I heard nothing other than he's apparently in a well-connected family in Canton, and Colin is his nephew who wasn't present at the house when Mr. O'Keefe and Ms. Reed were present at the house. So again, I think it's a stronger argument, certainly, if we're trying to bootstrap onto a Bowdoin defense, and counsel will probably likely be allowed to at least investigate that as far as impeachment, cross-examination, things of that nature, but there is absolutely nothing beyond just a fertile imagination and rank speculation as it applies to a third-party culprit defense. And for that reason, the Commonwealth's motion to exclude it should be allowed.
The only thing I'd like to correct, Your Honor, is, well, or at least point out, is that you know, the car pinged at 5:30.
So hold on until you get to the microphone.
Yeah, I'm sorry. The car pinged at 5:36 p.m., indicating that it was in the Sallyport. There is an outdoor camera where you can see the car about to enter the Sallyport at 5:31. Of course, you can't see the taillight in that outdoor camera. But Mr. Lally just argued before you, well, the reason why there's no video of the car between 5:08 and 5:50 is that it's motion activated. And I just ask the court to use common sense here, that if the car's entering, and by the way, the car's there at 5:50 with a couple of people around it, when the camera comes back on, you see the car. So unless it was teleported in a split second so that the interior camera would not pick up motion, it drove into the Sallyport. I believe that's the definition of motion, and it should have been picked up, according to Mr. Lally's own words.
Okay, so when you walk away from the microphone, it's harder for the court reporter to hear you, Mr. Unetti.
And I apologize, Judge. It's You know, according to Mr. Lally's own words, it should have picked up the movement.
Okay. All right. So I believe that's the last motion. So why don't we recess until 2 o'clock, and I'll see you back here at 2. Mr. Lally, will you have Ms. Gilman, who I did see walk in here at one point, set up the screen right where we normally keep it?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
You are muted. You are unmuted.
All right, Jim, I need just a minute with the computer, please. Okay, thank you.
Back on the record on the Karen Reed matter.
Okay, so good afternoon, counsel. Good afternoon, Ms. Gilman. I appreciate you being here. Before we see this video, just briefly, I just want to say that there were really only two motions that I'm comfortable with deciding by the 2 o'clock call here. I don't know if I already allowed that, but that's allowed. And the Commonwealth's motion in limine, Jim, I think this is 317. Commonwealth's motion in limine to prohibit reference to any federal investigations conducted by the U.S. Attorney's Office or FBI. So that will come into evidence the way that it typically does here in Massachusetts. You can question as to a date where the statement was made under oath, and we can discuss it as it gets closer in more detail. So the other motions are under advisement. We'll talk about that when we come back to sort of housekeeping matters at the end of the day. So do you have that video all pulled up, Mr. Lally, for me to see?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
And, Your Honor, for the record, it's a little bit lengthy as far as the entirety of the video. The portion that I would be submitting to the court is from 7 minutes and 4 seconds until 9 minutes and 55 seconds.
Okay. Can we? Thank you.
So we left at the house, the back door, we just did the knock and left.
Okay. Can you explain to me what the process is right now?
Absolutely. So you're going to be booked just like last time. Go through the same process. It's going to be a little less time consuming. They're not going to do major case prints because we did those last time. Once you're booked and you go through this portion of it, we'll let you make a phone call just like last time. We'll make a phone call. Your parents will be able to bring you whatever other additional needs, things that you need.
Yeah.
And then tomorrow morning, you'll go and be arraigned at Norfolk Superior Court on the charges that were. I'm sure you'll go over the charges again when you're on the warrant.
But I'm on bail, so how can I be spending the night here again?
All right, so I'll explain that portion to you. As long as it's not going to interfere with you, are you ready to go?
Yeah, I'm just waiting for Ramsey.
Okay. So, initially, your arrest was on probable cause out of the district court, okay? So the charges that you were arrested on initially were out of district court, out of Stilton District. That's where the arraignment was. It was district-level charges. Today, grand jury indicted you on these charges, which is second-degree murder, vehicular homicide, and leaving the scene of a death. Okay? So those are the charges that grand jury indicted you on. So now you're being charged and will be arraigned in Superior Court, Norfolk County Superior Court in Devon. Okay?
So bail doesn't apply anymore?
Typically, I'm not, so we don't set the bail. But typically, once murder comes into play, people don't get bailed out.
So it's not manslaughter anymore, no. Is that the difference?
That's correct. It's a higher degree of taking a life. Okay, so that's the charges that you're being charged with now. And you were indicted by grand jury.
Okay, you're aware he was beaten up by Brian McCall Albert. I mean, we're all in on the same joke, right? My taillight was cracked and John was pulverized.
Okay, you need to abide by the rights that were afforded to you, okay? So you can talk if you want. If you want to talk, tell us what happened, that's fine. We'll listen, but you were ready to do your rights, okay? And I'm sure he's going to do it again. All right, if you want to talk to us, you want to give us a story? Definitely. But we'll take
it. I know you already know the story, so I don't need to.
All right. How long is the entire tape?
So that is Trooper Pai, who was the arresting officer from the barracks. So it goes, I believe, at least 90 minutes or so.
All right. Do you have the entire, we're not playing it now, but do you have the entire video? All right. I would like it marked for identification.
Sure.
I'd also like a copy of it so I can view the whole entire thing, put it all in context. I never like to see just sections.
Sure.
Can I get that for the weekend as well?
Oh, absolutely. And for the record, as far as I think a lot of that sort of preliminary stuff was more meant as context for the court. You know, okay. There's certain discussions about court procedure and things that I don't think should be put in front of the jury.
All right, so that was my concern as well. Okay, so it's something I'll watch a few times, and the whole thing as well. Okay. All right, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Aid for identification.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. Okay, so housekeeping matters. A few things that I still need, as you know, before we have the jury here on Tuesday. I need a statement of the case. I know you have a short statement of the case in your proposed supplemental questionnaire. I think it needs to be more than that. So before you leave today, I'd like you all to agree on a joint statement of the case. I need witness lists. If the witnesses are going to be called, I have to read their names, as you know, to the jury on Tuesday morning. Once we get a jury, and I know none of us knows how long that might take, how long will it take to put in the Commonwealth's case? You can tell me with DNA and without DNA.
So with that piece of DNA, I don't think that's going to add much more than you know, an hour or two at the most. But best guess, given the schedule as outlined previously by the court, I'd say probably at least 4 weeks. My hope is there are some witnesses fine just in regard to administrative things as far as, you know, working an establishment. This is a true and accurate copy of surveillance video from said establishment.
Have you had preliminary discussions about whether there would be stipulations to authenticity like that?
No, but I plan to before Tuesday.
Okay. And you'll do that, Ms. Giannetti? You'll have these conversations before Tuesday?
I'm completely open to that.
Okay. So with the Commonwealth's case going 4 weeks, how long does the defense think their case will go?
With the schedule that the court has outlined, we're estimating about 2 weeks, Judge.
Okay. All right. I need to tell the jurors how long it will take. So if you say 6 weeks, I'm going to tell them seven, which will make it longer for us to get a jury. But
right, understood. And then there's also the X factor of how long it takes to get a jury.
Right? Oh, exactly. No, I'm going to tell them once we get a jury, it will be 7 weeks, give or take.
And just while we're on this subject, Your Honor, does the court have any idea in terms of the availability of jurors every day of the week?
Have jurors on Fridays.
No jurors on Fridays.
No, and it gets progressively lower as the week goes on. But we've got jurors, once we start, the trial that is in paneling has priority over all other trials. So once we start, and I expect that we'll start on Tuesday, we'll do that. So there's a couple of things about the voir dire of the jurors. So we will do the voir dire, the individual voir dire of jurors over here at Sidebar. And only one lawyer from each side is permitted to ask the questions of the jurors. I think I'll probably be able to give you 5 minutes or so for each witness, no more. And I'd like to talk to you all at Sidebar now about your joint proposal of the questionnaire. This is something that is not public. It won't be made public until after it's decided upon and after it is presented to the jurors and they've filled it out. So a blank copy will be available then pursuant to what the law is. So why don't I see counsel at Sidebar? Excuse me? Yes, thank you. All right, so is that everything regarding housekeeping, logistics, things like that?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. All right. So we'll see you on Tuesday morning. All right. All right, just so we're clear, there's nothing else logistically or jury impanelment, right? We're good?
I believe so, Your Honor, yes.
Okay, thank you very much. All right. Thank you. So we'll see everybody Tuesday morning. So
need to speak. Is there a Zoom off?
Goodbye.
Galoshes. Come on, you guys have never had
that's what galoshes are.
More raw courtroom coverage of the trial of Karen Reed is coming up from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast. Press subscribe so you don't miss a minute.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
Confused on where to start with weight loss medication? See the lowest prices available with or without insurance for Wegovy, Zepbound, and more at TryLifeMD.com. 95% of LifeMD patients said starting their weight loss journey was simple. Listen to Tara's story after losing 42 pounds.
You just take your shot. It doesn't feel like you're on a diet. What I wasn't expecting it to do was to shut off the food noise. I had gone from 237 to 195. This was life-altering, and if I can do it, I feel like anybody can do it.
Get your free insurance benefits check in minutes right now at TryLifeMD.com. Nearly 96% of patients said they would recommend the LifeMD program to anyone who wants to lose weight. Get started right now at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.